30 kilometers wide. Plasteel and armor plas, all of it.
I know. Duncan lowered the scope and returned it to Tormsa.
It was called Barony.
Yes, sigh,
Tormsa said.
That's what they call it now, Duncan said. I have some different names for it.
Duncan took a deep breath to put down the old hatreds. Those people were all dead. Only the building remained, and the memories. He scanned the city around that enormous structure. The place was a sprawling mass of warrens. Green spaces lay scattered throughout, each of them behind high walls. Single residences with private parks, Teg had said. The monoscope had revealed guards walking the wall tops. Tormsa spat on the ground in front of him.
Harkonnen place.
They built to make people feel small, Duncan said.
Tormsa nodded.
Small. No power in you.
The guide had become almost loquacious, Duncan thought. Occasionally, during the night, Duncan had defied the order for silence and tried to make conversation. What animals made these passages? It had seemed a logical question for people trotting along an obvious animal track, even the musty smell of beasts in it.
Do not talk,
Tormsa snapped. Later, Duncan asked why they could not get a vehicle of some sort and escape in that. Even a ground car would be preferable to this painful march across country, where one route felt much like another. Tormsa stopped them in a patch of moonlight and looked at Duncan as though he suspected his charge had suddenly become bereft of sense.
Vehicles can follow.
No one can follow us when we're on foot.
Followers also must be on foot. Here they will be killed. They know.
What a weird place. What a primitive place. In the shelter of the Bene Gesserit keep, Duncan had not realized the nature of the planet around him. Later in the no-globe, he had been removed from contact with the outside. He had pre-Gola and Gola memories, but how inadequate those were. When he thought about it now, he realized there had been clues. It was obvious that Gamu possessed rudimentary weather control, and Teg had said that the orbiting monitors that guarded the planet from attack were of the best. Everything for protection, damned little for comfort. It was like Arrakis in that respect. Arrakis, he corrected himself. Teg. Did the old man survive? A captive? What did it mean to be captured here in this age? It had meant brutal slavery in the old Harkonnen days. Bosmali and Lucilla. He glanced at Tormsa.
Will we find Bosmali and Lucilla in the city?
If they get through.
Duncan glanced down at his clothing. Was it a sufficient disguise? A Tlelaxu master and companion? People would think the companion a face dancer, of course. Face dancers were dangerous. The baggy trousers were of some material Duncan had never before seen. It felt like wool to the hand, but he sensed that it was artificial. When he spat on it, spittle did not adhere, and the smell was not of wool. His fingers detected a uniformity of texture that no natural material could present. The long, soft boots and watch cap were of the same fabric. The garments were loose and puffy except at the ankles. Not quilted, though. Insulated by some trick of manufacture that trapped dead air between the layers. The color was a mottled green and gray. Excellent camouflage here. Tormsa was dressed in similar garments.
How long do we wait here? Duncan asked.
Tormsa shook his head for silence. The guide was seated now, knees up, arms wrapped around his legs, head cradled against his knees, eyes looking outward over the valley. During the night's trip, Duncan had found the clothing remarkably comfortable. Except for that once in the water, his feet stayed warm, but not too warm. There was plenty of room in trousers, shirt, and jacket for his body to move easily. Nothing abraded his flesh.
Who makes clothing such as this?
Duncan asked.
We made it,
Tormsa growled.
Be silent.
This was no different than the pre-awakening days at the Sisterhood's Keep, Duncan thought. Tormsa was saying, no need for you to know. Presently, Tormsa stretched out his legs and straightened. He appeared to relax. He glanced at Duncan.
Friends in the city signaled that there are searchers overhead.
Thopters?
Yes.
Then what do we do?
You must do what I do, and nothing else.
You're just sitting there.
For now, We will go down into the valley soon.
But how?
When you traverse such country as this, you become one of the animals that live here. Look at the tracks and see how they walk and how they lie down for a rest.
But can't the searchers tell the difference between...
If the animals browse, you make the motions of browsing. If searchers come, you continue to do what it was you were doing, what any animal would do. Searchers will be high in the air. That is lucky for us. They cannot tell animal from human unless they come down.
But won't they?
They trust their machines and the motions they see. They are lazy. They fly high. That way the search goes faster. They trust their own intelligence to read their instruments and tell which is animal and which is human.
So they'll just go by us if they think we're wild animals.
If they doubt, they will scan us a second time. We must not change the pattern of movements after being scanned.
It was a long speech for the usually taciturn Tormsa. He studied Duncan carefully now.
You understand?
How will I know when we're being scanned?
Your gut will tingle. You will feel in your stomach the fizz of a drink that no man should swallow.
Duncan nodded. Ixion scanners.
Let it not alarm you,
Tormsa said.
Animals here are accustomed to it. Sometimes they may pause, but only for an instant, and then they go on as if nothing has happened, which for them is true. It is only for us that something evil may happen.
Presently, Tormsa stood.
We will go down into the valley now. Follow closely. Do exactly what I do and nothing else.
Duncan fell into step behind his guide. Soon they were under the covering trees. Sometime during the night's passage, Duncan realized, he had begun to accept his place in the schemes of others. A new patience was taking over his awareness, and there was excitement, goaded by curiosity. What kind of a universe had come out of the Atreides times? Gamu. What a strange place Gedi Prime had become. Slowly, but distinctly, things were being revealed, and each new thing opened a view to more that could be learned. He could feel patterns taking shape. One day, he thought, there would be a single pattern, and then he would know why they had brought him back from the dead. Yes, it was a matter of opening doors, he thought. You opened one door, and that let you into a place where there were other doors. You chose a door in this new place and examined what that revealed to you. There might be times when you were forced to try all of the doors, but the more doors you opened, the more certain you became of which door to open next. Finally, a door would open into a place you recognized. Then you would say, "Ah, this explains everything."
"Searchers come,"
Tormsa said.
"We are browsing animals now."
He reached up to a screening bush and tore down a small limb. Duncan did the same. I must rule with eye and claw, as the hawk among lesser birds. Atreides' assertion, reference BG Archives. At daybreak, Teg emerged from the concealing windbreaks beside a main road. The road was a wide, flat thoroughfare, beam-hardened and kept bare of plant life. 10 lanes, Teg estimated, suitable for both vehicle and foot traffic. There was mostly foot traffic on it at this hour. He had brushed most of the dust off his clothing and made sure there were no signs of rank on it. His grey hair was not as neat as he usually preferred, but he had only his fingers for a comb. Traffic on the road was headed toward the city of Yasai, many kilometres across the valley. The morning was cloudless, with a light breeze in his face moving toward the sea somewhere far behind him. During the night, he had come to a delicate balance with his new awareness. Things flickered in his second vision. Knowledge of things around him before those things occurred, awareness of where he must put his foot in the next step. Behind this lay the reactive trigger that he knew could snap him into the blurring responses that flesh should not be able to accommodate. Reason could not explain the thing. He felt that he walked precariously along the cutting edge of a knife. Try as he might, he could not resolve what had happened to him under the T-probe. Was it akin to what a reverend mother experienced in the spice agony? but he sensed no accumulation of other memories out of his past. He did not think the sisters could do what he did. The doubled vision that told him what to anticipate from every movement within the range of his senses seemed a new kind of truth. Teg's mentor teachers had always assured him there was a form of living truth not susceptible to proof by the marshalling of ordinary facts. It was carried sometimes in fables and poetry, and often went contrary to desires, so he had been told. "The most difficult experience for a Mentat to accept," they said. Teg had always reserved judgment on this pronouncement, but now he was forced to accept it. The T-probe had thrust him over a threshold into a new reality. He did not know why he chose this particular moment to emerge from hiding, except that it fitted him into an acceptable flow of human movement. Most of that movement on the road was composed of market gardeners towing panniers of vegetables and fruit. The panniers were supported behind them on cheap suspensers. Awareness of that food sent sharp hunger pains through him, but he forced himself to ignore them. With experience of more primitive planets in his long service to the Bene Gesserit, he saw this human activity as little different from that of farmers leading loaded animals. The foot traffic struck him as an odd mixture of ancient and modern. Farmers afoot, their produce floating behind them on perfectly ordinary technological devices. Except for the suspensers, this scene was very like a similar day in humankind's most ancient past. A draft animal was a draft animal, even if it came off an assembly line in an Ixion factory. Using his new second vision, Teg chose one of the farmers, a squat, dark-skinned man with heavy features and thickly calloused hands. The man walked with a defiant sense of independence. He towed 8 large panniers piled with rough-skinned melons. The smell of them was a mouth-watering agony to Teg as he matched his stride to that of the farmer. Teg strode for a few minutes in silence, then ventured,
"Is this the best road to Yasai?"
"It is a long way," the man said.
He had a guttural voice, something cautious in it. Teg glanced back at the loaded panniers. The farmer looked sidelong at Teg.
"We go to a market center. Others take our produce from there to Yasai."
As they talked, Teg realized the farmer had guided, almost herded him close to the edge of the road. The man glanced back and jerked his head slightly, nodding forward. 3 more farmers came up beside them and closed in around Teg and his companion until tall panniers concealed them from the rest of the traffic. Teg tensed. What were they planning? He sensed no menace, though. His doubled vision detected nothing violent in his immediate vicinity. A heavy vehicle sped past them and on ahead. Teg knew of its passage only by the smell of burned fuel, the wind that shook the panniers, the thrumming of a powerful engine and sudden tension in his companions. The high panniers completely hid the passing vehicle.
"We have been looking for you to protect you, Basha," the farmer beside him said. "There are many who hunt you, but none of them with us along here."
Teg shot a startled glance at the man.
"We served with you at Randatai," the farmer said.
Teg swallowed. Randatai? He was a moment recalling it. Only a minor skirmish in his long history of conflicts and negotiations.
"I am sorry, but I do not know your names," Teg said.
"Be glad that you do not know our names. It is better that way."
"But I'm grateful."
"This is a small repayment, which we are glad to make, Basha."
"I must get to Yasai," Teg said.
"It is dangerous there."
"It is dangerous everywhere."
"We guessed you would go to Yasai. Someone will come soon and you will ride in concealment. Ah, here he comes."
"We have not seen you here, Basha. You have not been here."
One of the other farmers took over the towing of his companion's load, pulling 2 strings of panniers while the farmer Teg had chosen hustled Teg under a tow rope and into a dark vehicle. Teg glimpsed shiny plasteel and plaz as the vehicle slowed only briefly for the pickup. The door closed sharply behind him, and he found himself on a soft upholstered seat, alone in the back of a ground car. The car picked up speed and soon was beyond the marching farmers. The windows around Teg had been darkened, giving him a dusky view of the passing scene. The driver was a shaded silhouette. This first chance to relax in warm comfort since his capture almost lured Teg into sleep. He sensed no threats. His body still ached from the demands he had made on it and from the agonies of the T-probe. He told himself, though, that he must stay awake and alert. The driver leaned sideways and spoke over his shoulder without turning.
They've been hunting for you for 2 days, Basha. Some think you're already off-planet.
2 days? The stunner and whatever else they had done to him had left him unconscious for a long time. This only added to his hunger. He tried to make the flesh-embedded chrono play against his vision centers, and it only flickered as it had done each time he consulted it since the T-probe. His time sense and all references to it were changed. So some thought he had left Gamel. Teg did not ask who hunted him. Tleilaxuan people from the scattering had been in that attack and the subsequent torture. Teg glanced around his conveyance. It was one of those beautiful old pre-scattering ground cars, the marks of the finest Ixion manufacture on it. He had never before ridden in one, but he knew about them. Restorers picked them up to renew, rebuild, whatever they did that brought back the ancient sense of quality. Teg had been told that such vehicles often were found abandoned in strange places, in old broken-down buildings, in culverts, locked away in machinery warehouses, in farm fields. Again his driver leaned slightly sideways and spoke over one shoulder.
"Do you have an address where you wish to be taken in Yasai, Basha?"
Teg called up his memory of the contact points he had identified on his first tour of Gamu and gave one of these to the man.
"Do you know that place?"
"It is mostly a meeting and drinking establishment, Basha. I hear they serve good food too, but anyone can enter if he has the price."
Not knowing why he had made that particular choice, Teg said,
"We will chance it."
He did not think it necessary to tell the driver that there were private dining rooms at the address. The mention of food brought back sharp hunger cramps. Teg's arms began to tremble and he was several minutes restoring calmness. Last night's activities had almost drained him, he realized. He sent a searching gaze around the car's interior, wondering if there might be food or drink concealed here. The car's restoration had been accomplished with loving care, but he saw no hidden compartments. Such cars were not all that rare in some quarters, he knew, but all of them spoke of wealth. Who owned this one? Not the driver, certainly. That one had all the signs of a hired professional, but if a message had been sent to bring this car, then others knew of Teg's location.
"Will we be stopped and searched?" Teg asked.
"Not this car, Basha. The Planetary Bank of Gamu owns it."
Teg absorbed this silently. That bank had been one of his contact points. He had studied key branches carefully on his inspection tour. This memory drew him back into his responsibilities as guardian of the Gola.
"My companions," Teg ventured. "Are they?"
"Others have that in hand, Basha. I cannot say."
"Can word be taken to—"
"When it is safe, Basha."
"Of course."
Teg sank back into the cushions and studied his surroundings. These ground cars had been built with much plaz and almost indestructible plasteel. It was other things that went sour with age. Upholstery, headliners, the electronics, the suspensor installations, the ablative liners of the turbofan ducts. And the adhesives deteriorated no matter what you did to preserve them. The restorers had made this one look as though it had just been cranked out of the factory, all subdued glowing in the metals, upholstery that moulded itself to him with a faint sound of crinkling, and the smell, that indefinable aroma of newness, a mixture of polish and fine fabrics with just a hint of ozone bite underneath from the smoothly working electronics. Nowhere in it, though, was there the smell of food.
"How long to Yasai?"
Teg asked.
"Another half hour, Basha. Is there a problem that requires more speed? I don't want to attract—"
"I am very hungry."
The driver glanced left and right. There were no more farmers around them here. The roadway was almost empty except for two heavy transport pods with their tractors holding to the right verge and a large lorry hauling a towering automatic fruit picker.
"It is dangerous to delay for long," the driver said, "but I know a place where I think I can at least get you a quick bowl of soup."
"Anything would be welcome. I have not eaten for 2 days and there has been much activity."
They came to a crossroads and the driver turned left onto a narrow track through tall, evenly spaced conifers. Presently he turned onto a one-lane drive through the trees. The low building at the end of this track was built of dark stones and had a black plaz roof. The windows were narrow and glistened with protective burner nozzles. The driver said,
"Just a minute, sir."
He got out and Teg had his first look at the man's face. Extremely thin, with a long nose and tiny mouth. The visible tracery of surgical reconstruction laced his cheeks. The eyes glowed silver, obviously artificial. He turned away and went into the house. When he returned, he opened Tegg's door.
Please be quick, sir. The one inside is heating suit for you. I've said you were a banker, no need to pay.
The ground was icy crisp underfoot. Tegg had to stoop slightly for the doorway. He entered a dark hallway, wood-panelled and with a well-lighted room at the end. The smell of food there drew him like a magnet. His arms were trembling once more. A small table had been set beside a window with a view of an enclosed and covered garden. Bushes, heavy with red flowers, almost concealed the stone wall that defined the garden. Yellow hot plaz gleamed over the space, bathing it in a summery artificial light. Tegg sank gratefully into the single chair at the table. White linen, he saw, with an embossed edge. A single soup spoon. A door creaked at his right, and a squat figure entered carrying a bowl from which steam arose. The man hesitated when he saw Tegg, then brought the bowl to the table and placed it in front of Tegg. Alerted by that hesitation, Tegg forced himself to ignore the tempting aroma drifting to his nostrils and concentrated instead on his companion.
It is good soup, sir. I made it myself.
An artificial voice. Tegg saw the scars at the sides of the jaw. There was the look of an ancient mechanical about this man, an almost necklace head attached to thick shoulders, arms that seemed oddly jointed at both shoulders and elbows, legs that appeared to swing only from the hips. He stood motionless now, but he had entered here with a slightly jerking sway that said he was mostly replacement artificials. The look of suffering in his eyes could not be avoided.
I know I'm not pretty, sir,
the man rasped.
I was ruined in the Alajori explosion.
Tegg had no idea what the Alajori explosion might have been, but it obviously was presumed he knew. Ruined, however, was an interesting accusation against fate.
I was wondering if I knew you, Tegg said.
No one here knows anyone else,
the man said.
Eat your soup.
He pointed upward at the coiled tip of quiescent snooper, the glow of its lights revealing that it read its surroundings and found no poison.
The food is safe here.
Tegg looked at the dark brown liquid in his bowl. Lumps of solid meat were visible in it. He reached for the spoon. His trembling hand made two attempts before grasping the spoon, and even then he sloshed most of the liquid out of the spoon before he could lift it a millimeter. A steadying hand gripped Tegg's wrist, and the artificial voice spoke softly in Tegg's ear.
I do not know what they did to you, Basha, but no one will harm you here without crossing my dead body.
You know me?
Many would die for you, Basha. My son lives because of you.
Tegg allowed himself to be helped. It was all he could do to swallow the first spoonful. The liquid was rich, hot, and soothing. His hand steadied presently, and he nodded to the man to release the wrist.
More, sir?
Tegg realized then that he had emptied the bowl. It was tempting to say yes, but the driver had said to make haste.
Thank you, but I must go.
You have not been here,
the man said. When they were once more back on the main road, Tegg sat back against the ground car's cushions and reflected on the curious echoing quality of what the ruined man had said. The same words the farmer had used. You have not been here. It had the feeling of a common response, and it said something about changes in Gamo since Tegg had surveyed the place. They entered the outskirts of Yasai presently, and Tegg wondered if he should attempt to disguise. The ruined man had recognized him quickly.
Where do the honored Matres hunt for me now?
Tegg asked.
Everywhere, Basha. We cannot guarantee your safety, but steps are being taken. I will make it known where I have delivered you. Do they say why they hunt me?
They never explain, Basha.
How long have they been on Gamo?
Too long, sir. Since I was a child, and I was a Bolton at Randatai.
100 years at least, Tegg thought. Time to gather many forces into their hands, if Taraza's fears were to be credited.
Tegg credited them.
Trust no one those whores can influence, Taraza had said.
Tegg sensed no threat to him in his present position, though. He could only absorb the secrecy that obviously enclosed him now. He did not press for more details. They were well into Yasai, and he glimpsed the black bulk of the ancient Harkonnen seat of barony through occasional gaps between the walls that enclosed the great private residences. The car turned onto a street of small commercial establishments.
cheap buildings constructed for the most part of salvaged materials that displayed their origins in poor fits and unmatched colours. Gaudy signs advised that the wares inside were the finest, the repair services better than those elsewhere. It was not that Yasai had deteriorated or even gone to seed, Teg thought. Growth here had been diverted into something worse than ugly. Someone had chosen to make this place repellent. That was the key to most of what he saw in the city. Time had not stopped here. It had retreated. This was no modern city full of bright transport pods and insulated usiform buildings. This was random jumbles, ancient structures joined to ancient structures, some built to individual tastes and some obviously designed with some long-gone necessity in mind. Everything about Yasai was joined in a proximity whose disarray just managed to avoid chaos. What saved it, Teg knew, was the old pattern of thoroughfares along which this hodgepodge had been assembled. Chaos was held at bay, although what pattern there was in the streets conformed to no master plan. Streets met and crossed at odd angles, seldom squared. Seen from the air, the place was a crazy quilt with only the giant black rectangle of ancient barony to speak of an organizing plan. The rest of it was architectural rebellion. Teg saw suddenly that this place was a lie, plastered over with other lies based on previous lies, and such a mad mix-up that they might never dig through to a usable truth. All of Gamu was that way. Where could such insanity have had its beginnings? Was it the Harkonnens doing?
We are here, sir.
The driver drew up to the curb in front of a windowless building face, all flat black plasteel and with a single ground-level door. No salvaged material in this construction. Teg recognized the place, the bolt hole he had chosen. Unidentified things flickered in Teg's second vision, but he sensed no immediate menace. The driver opened Teg's door and stood to one side.
Not much activity here at this hour, sir. I will get inside quickly.
Without a backward glance, Teg darted across the narrow walk and into the building, a small, brightly lighted foyer of polished white plaz, and only banks of commies to greet him. He ducked into a lift tube and punched the remembered coordinates. This tube, he knew, angled upward through the building to the 57th floor rear, where there were some windows. He remembered a private dining room of dark reds and heavy brown furnishings, a hard-eyed female with the obvious signs of Bene Gesserit training, but no Reverend Mother. The tube disgorged him into the remembered room, but there was no one to receive him. Teg glanced around at the solid brown furnishings. Four windows along the far wall were concealed behind thick, maroon draperies. Teg knew he had been seen. He waited patiently, using his newly learned doubling vision to anticipate trouble. There was no indication of attack. He took up a position to one side of the tube outlet and glanced around him once more. Teg had a theory about the relationship between rooms and their windows, the number of windows, their placement, their size, height from the floor, relationship of room size to window size, the elevation of the room, windows curtained or draped, and all of this mentat interpreted against knowledge of the uses to which a room was put. Rooms could be fitted to a kind of pecking order, defined with extreme sophistication. Emergency uses might throw such distinctions out the window, but they otherwise were quite reliable. Lack of windows in an above-ground room conveyed a particular message. If humans occupied such a room, it did not necessarily mean secrecy was the main goal. He had seen unmistakable signs in scholastic settings that windowless schoolrooms were both a retreat from the exterior world and a strong statement of dislike for children. This room, however, presented something different. Conditional secrecy, plus the need to keep occasional watch on that exterior world. Protective secrecy when required. His opinion was reinforced when he crossed the room and twitched one of the draperies aside. The windows were tripled armor plaz. So, keeping watch on that world outside might draw attack. That was the opinion of whoever had ordered the room protected this way. Once more, Teg twitched the drapery aside. He glanced at the corner glazing. Prismatic reflectors there amplified the view along the adjacent wall to both sides and from roof to ground.
Well.
His previous visit had not given him time for this closer examination, but now he made a more positive assessment. A very interesting room. Teg dropped the drapery and turned just in time to see a tall man enter from the tube slot. Teg's doubled vision provided a firm prediction on the stranger. This man brought concealed danger. The newcomer was plainly military. The way he carried himself, the quick eye for details that only a trained and experienced officer would observe. And there was something else in his manner that made Teg stiffen. This was a betrayer, a mercenary available to the highest bidder.
"Damned nasty the way they treated you," the man greeted Teg.
The voice was a deep baritone, with an unconscious assumption of personal power in it. The accent was one Teg had never before heard. This was someone from the Scattering, a Basha or equivalent, Teg estimated. Still, there was no indication of immediate attack. When Teg did not answer, the man said,
"Oh, sorry, I am Muzaffar, Jaffar Muzaffar, regional commander for the forces of Dur."
Teg had never heard of the forces of Dur. Questions crowded Teg's mind, but he kept them to himself. Anything he said here might betray weakness. Where were the people who had met him here before?
Why did I choose this place?
The decision had been made with such inner assurance.
"Place, be comfortable,"
Muzaffar said, indicating a small divan with a low serving table in front of it.
"I assure you that none of what has happened to you was of my doing. Tried to put a stop to it when I heard, but you'd already left the scene."
Teg heard the other thing in this Muzaffar's voice now, caution bordering on fear. So this man had either heard about or seen the shack and the clearing.
"Damned clever of you," Muzaffar said, "having your attack force wait until your captors were concentrating on trying to get information out of you. Did they learn anything?"
Teg shook his head silently from side to side. He felt on the edge of being ignited into a blurred response to attack, yet he sensed no immediate violence here. What were these lost ones doing? But Muzaffar and his people had made a wrong assessment of what had happened in the room of the T-probe. That was clear.
"Please, be seated,"
Muzaffar said. Teg took the proffered seat on the divan. Muzaffar sat in a deep chair facing Teg at a slight angle on the other side of the serving table. There was a crouching sense of alertness in Muzaffar. He was prepared for violence. Teg studied the man with interest. Muzaffar had revealed no real rank, only commander. Tall fellow, with a wide, ruddy face and a big nose. The eyes were grey-green and had the trick of focusing just behind Teg's right shoulder when either of them spoke. Teg had known a spy once who did that.
"Well, well," Muzaffar said, "I've read and heard a great deal about you since coming here."
Teg continued to study him silently. Muzaffar's hair had been cropped close, and there was a purple scar about 3 millimeters long across the scalp line above the left eye. He wore an open bush jacket of light green and matching trousers, not quite a uniform, but there was a neatness about him that spoke of customary spit and polish. The shoes attested to this. Teg thought he probably could see his own reflection in their light brown surfaces if he bent close.
"Never expected to meet you personally, of course," Muzaffar said. "Consider it a great honor."
"I know very little about you except that you command a force from the Scattering," Teg said.
"Humph. Not much to know, really."
Once more, hunger pangs gripped Teg. His gaze went to the button beside the tube slot, which he remembered would summon a waiter. This was a place where humans did the work usually assigned to automata, an excuse for keeping a large force assembled at the ready. Misinterpreting Teg's interest in the tube slot, Muzaffar said,
"Please don't think of leaving. Having my own medic come in to take a look at you. Shouldn't be but a moment. Appreciate it if you'd wait quietly until he arrives."
"I was merely thinking of placing an order for some food," Teg said.
"Advise you to wait until the doctor's had his look-see. Stunners leave some nasty after-effects."
"So you know about that?"
"Know about the whole damned fiasco. You and your man Burzmali are a force to be reckoned with."
Before Teg could respond, the tube slot disgorged a tall man in a jacketed red single suit, a man so bone-skinny that his clothing gaped and flapped about him. The diamond tattoo of a Sook doctor had been burned into his high forehead, but the mark was orange, and not the customary black. The doctor's eyes were concealed by a glistening orange cover that hid their true colour. An addict of some kind? Teg wondered. There was no smell of the familiar narcotics around him, not even mélange. There was a tart smell, though, almost like some fruit.
There you are, Solitz, Muzaffar said. He gestured at Teg. Give him a good scan. Stunner hit him day before yesterday.
Solitz produced a recognizable Souk scanner, compact and fitting into one hand. Its probe field produced a low hum.
So you're a Souk doctor, Teg said, looking pointedly at the orange brand on the forehead.
Yes, Basha. My training and conditioning are the finest in our ancient tradition.
I've never seen the identifying mark in that colour, Teg said.
The doctor passed his scanner around Teg's head.
The colour of the tattoo makes no difference, Basha. What is behind it is all that matters.
He lowered the scanner to Teg's shoulders, then down across the body. Teg waited for the humming to stop. The doctor stood back and addressed Muzaffar.
He is quite fit, Field Marshal. Remarkably fit, considering his age, but he desperately needs sustenance.
Yes, well, that's fine then, Solitz. Take care of that. The Bashar is our guest.
I will order a meal suited to his needs, Solitz said. Eat it slowly, Bashar.
Solitz did a smart about face that set his jacket and trousers flapping. The tube slot swallowed him.
Field Marshal? Teg asked. A revival of ancient titles in the Dur, Muzaffar said. The Dur? Teg ventured. Stupid of me!
Muzaffar produced a small case from a side pocket of his jacket and extracted a thin folder. Teg recognized a holostat similar to one he had carried himself during his long service, pictures of home and family. Muzaffar placed the holostat on the table between them and tapped the control button. The full-colour image of a bushy green expanse of jungle came alive in miniature above the tabletop.
Home, Muzaffar said. Frame bush in the centre there.
A finger indicated a place in the projection.
First one that ever obeyed me. People laughed at me for choosing the first one that way and sticking with it.
Teg stared at the projection, aware of a deep sadness in Muzaffar's voice. The indicated bush was a spindly grouping of thin frames with bright blue bulbs dangling from the tips.
Frame bush? Rather thin thing, I know, Muzaffar said,
removing his pointing finger from the projection.
Not secure at all. Had to defend myself a few times in the first months with it. Grew rather fond of it, though. They respond to that, you know. It's the best home in all the deep valleys now, by the eternal rock of Dur.
Muzaffar stared at Teg's puzzled expression.
Damn, you don't have frame bushes, of course. You must forgive my crashing ignorance. We've a great deal to teach each other, I think.
You called that home, Teg said.
Oh, yes, with proper direction once they learn to obey, of course. A frame bush will grow itself into a magnificent residence. It only takes 4 or 5 standards.
Standards, Teg thought. So the Lost Ones still used the standard year. The tube slot hissed, and a young woman in a blue serving gown backed into the room, towing a Suspenser Boyd hot pod, which she positioned near the table in front of Teg. Her clothing was of the type Teg had seen during his original inspection, but the pleasantly round face she turned to him was unfamiliar. Her scalp had been depilated, leaving an expanse of prominent veins. Her eyes were watery blue, and there was something cowed in her posture. She opened the hot pod, and the spicy odours of the food wafted across Teg's nostrils. Teg was alerted, but he sensed no immediate threat. He could see himself eating the food without ill effect. The young woman put a row of dishes on the table in front of him and arranged the eating implements neatly at one side.
I've no snooper, but I'll taste the foods if you wish, Muzaffar said.
Not necessary, Teg said.
He knew this would raise questions, but felt they would suspect him of being a truth-sayer. Teg's gaze locked onto the food. Without any conscious decision, he leaned forward and began eating. Familiar with Mentat hunger, he was surprised at his own reactions. Using the brain in Mentat mode consumed calories at an alarming rate, but this was a new necessity driving him. He felt his own survival controlling his actions. but this hunger went beyond anything of previous experience. The soup he had eaten with some caution at the house of the ruined man had not aroused such a demanding reaction. The souk doctor chose correctly, Teg thought. This food had been selected directly out of the scanner's summation. The young woman kept bringing more dishes from hot pods ordered via the tube slot. Teg had to get up in the middle of the meal and relieve himself in an adjoining washroom, conscious there of the hidden commies that were keeping him under surveillance. He knew by his physical reactions that his digestive system had speeded up to a new level of bodily necessity. When he returned to the table, he felt just as hungry as though he had not eaten. The serving woman began to show signs of surprise, and then alarm. Still, she kept bringing more food at his demand. Muzaffar watched with growing amazement but said nothing. Teg felt the supportive replacement of the food, the precise caloric adjustment that the souk doctor had ordered. They obviously had not thought about quantity, though. The girl obeyed his demands in a kind of walking shock. Muzaffar spoke finally.
"Must I say, I've never before seen anyone eat that much at one sitting. Can't see how you do it, nor why."
Teg sat back, satisfied at last knowing he had aroused questions that could not be answered truthfully.
"A Mentat thing," Teg lied. "I've been through a very strenuous time."
"Amazing," Muzaffar said.
He arose. When Teg started to stand, Muzaffar gestured for him to remain.
"No need. We've prepared quarters for you right next door. Safer not to move you yet."
The young woman departed with the empty hot pods. Teg studied Muzaffar. Something had changed during the meal. Muzaffar watched him with a coldly measuring stare.
"You've an implanted communicator," Teg said. "You have received new orders."
"It would not be advisable for your friends to attack this place," Muzaffar said.
"You think that's my plan?"
"What is your plan, Bashar?"
Teg smiled.
"Very well."
Muzaffar's gaze went out of focus as he listened to his communicator. When he once more concentrated on Teg, his gaze had the look of a predator. Teg felt himself buffeted by that gaze, recognizing that someone else was coming to this room. The field marshal thought of this new development as something extremely dangerous to his dinner guest, but Teg saw nothing that could defeat his new abilities.
"You think I am your prisoner?" Teg said.
"By the eternal rock, Bashar, you are not what I expected."
"The honored Matre who is coming, what does she expect?" Ted asked.
"Bashar, I warn you, do not take that tone with her. You have not the slightest concept of what is about to happen to you."
"An honored Matre is about to happen to me," Teg said.
"And I wish you well of her."
Muzaffar pivoted and left via the tube slot. Teg stared after him. He could see the flickering of second vision like a light blinking around the tube slot. The honored Matre was near but not yet ready to enter this room. First, she would consult with Muzaffar. The field marshal would not be able to tell this dangerous female anything really important. Memory never recaptures reality. Memory reconstructs. All reconstructions change the original, becoming external frames of reference that inevitably fall short. Mentat Handbook. Lucilla and Basmali entered Yasai from the south into a lower-class quarter with widely spaced streetlights. It lacked only an hour of midnight, and yet people thronged the streets in this quarter. Some walked quietly, some chatted with drug-enhanced vigor, some only watched expectantly. They wadded up at the corners and held Lucilla's fascinated attention as she passed. Basmali urged her to walk faster, an eager customer anxious to get her alone. Lucilla kept her covert attention on the people. What did they do here? Those men waiting in the doorway, for what did they wait? Workers in heavy aprons emerged from a wide passage as Lucilla and Basmali passed. There was a thick smell of rank sewage and perspiration about them. The workers, almost equally divided between male and female, were tall, heavy-bodied, and with thick arms. Lucilla could not imagine what their occupation might be, but they were of a single type, and they made her realize how little she knew of Gamu. The workers hawked and spat into the gutter as they emerged into the night. Ridding themselves of some contaminant?
Basmali put his mouth close to Lucilla's ear and whispered,
"Those workers are the Bordanos."
She risked a glance back at them where they walked toward a side street.
"Bordanos?
Ah, yes. People trained and bred to work the compression machinery that harnessed sewer gases. They had been bred to remove the sense of smell, and the musculature of shoulders and arms had been increased. Basmali guided her around a corner and out of sight of the Bordanos. 5 children emerged from a dark doorway beside them and wheeled into line following Lucilla and Basmali. Lucilla noted their hands clutching small objects. They followed with a strange intensity. Abruptly, Basmali stopped and turned. The children also stopped and stared at him. It was clear to Lucilla that the children were prepared for some violence. Basmali clasped both hands in front of him and bowed to the children. He said,
"Guldur."
When Basmali resumed guiding her down the street, the children no longer followed.
"They would have stoned us," he said.
"Why?"
"They are children of a sect that follows Guldur, the local name for the tyrant."
Lucilla looked back, but the children were no longer in sight, and they had set off in search of another victim. Basmali guided her around another corner. Now they were in a street crowded with small merchants selling their wares from wheeled stands, food, clothing, small tools, and knives. A sing-song of shouts filled the air as the merchants tried to attract buyers. Their voices had that end of the workday lift, a false brilliance composed of the hope that old dreams would be fulfilled, yet coloured by the knowledge that life would not change for them. It occurred to Lucilla that the people of these streets pursued a fleeting dream, that the fulfilment they sought was not the thing itself, but a myth they had been conditioned to seek, the way racing animals were trained to chase after the whirling bait on the endless oval of the racetrack. In the street directly ahead of them, a burly figure in a thickly padded coat was engaged in loud-voiced argument with a merchant who offered a string bag filled with the dark red bulbs of a sweetly acid fruit. The fruit smell was thick all around them. The merchant complained,
"You would steal the food from the mouths of my children!"
The bulky figure spoke in a piping voice, the accent chillingly familiar to Lucilla.
"I too have children."
Lucilla controlled herself with an effort. When they were clear of the market street, she whispered to Basmali,
"That man in the heavy coat back there, a Tlelaxu master."
"Couldn't be," Basmali protested. "Too tall."
"2 of them, one on the shoulders of the other."
"You're sure?"
"I'm sure.
I've seen others like that since we arrived, but I didn't suspect."
"Many searchers are in these streets," she said.
Lucilla found that she did not much care for the everyday life of the gutter inhabitants of this gutter planet. She no longer trusted the explanation for bringing the Gola here. Of all those planets on which the precious Gola could have been raised, why had the Sisterhood chosen this one? Or was the Gola truly precious? Could it be that he was merely bait? Almost blocking the narrow mouth of an alley beside them was a man plying a tall device of whirling lights.
"Live!"
he shouted.
"Live!"
Lucilla slowed her pace to watch a passerby step into the alleyway and pass a coin to the proprietor, then lean into a concave basin made brilliant by the lights. The proprietor stared back at Lucilla. She saw a man with a narrow, dark face, the face of a Caledonian primitive on a body only slightly taller than that of a Tlelaxu master. There had been a look of contempt on his brooding face as he took the customer's money. The customer lifted his face from the basin with a shudder, and then left the alley, staggering slightly, his eyes glazed. Lucilla recognized the device. Users called it a hypnobong, and it was outlawed on all of the more civilized worlds. Basmali hurried her out of the view of the brooding hypnobong proprietor. They came to a wider side street, with a corner doorway set into the building across from them. Foot traffic all around, not a vehicle in sight. A tall man sat on the first step in the corner doorway, his knees drawn up close to his chin. His long arms were wrapped around his knees, the thin-fingered hands clasped tightly together. He wore a wide-brimmed black hat that shaded his face from the streetlights, but twin gleams from the shadows under that brim told Lucilla that this was no kind of human she had ever before encountered. This was something about which the Bene Gesserit had only speculated. Basmali waited until they were well away from the seated figure, before satisfying her curiosity.
"Futa," he whispered. "That's what they call themselves. They've only recently been seen here on Gamu."
"A Tlelaxu experiment,"
Lucilla guessed, and she thought, a mistake that has returned from the scattering.
What are they doing here? She asked.
Trading colony. So the natives here tell us.
Don't you believe it? Those are hunting animals that have been crossed with humans.
Ah, here we are,
Bosmali said. He guided Lucilla through a narrow doorway into a dimly lighted eating establishment. This was part of their disguise, Lucilla knew. Do what others in this quarter did. But she did not relish eating in this place, not with what she could interpret from the smells. The place had been crowded, but it was emptying as they entered.
This commercial was recommended highly,
Bosmali said as they seated themselves in a mecca slot and waited for the menu to be projected. Lucilla watched the departing customers. Night workers from nearby factories and offices, she guessed. They appeared anxious in their hurry, perhaps fearful of what might be done to them if they were tardy. How insulated she had been at the keep, she thought. She did not like what she was learning of Gamo. What a scruffy place this commercial was. The stools at the counter to her right had been scarred and chipped. The tabletop in front of her had been scored and rubbed with gritty cleaners until it no longer could be kept clean by the vacuum sweep whose nozzle she could see near her left elbow. There was no sign of even the cheapest sonic to maintain cleanliness. Food and other evidence of deterioration had accumulated in the table's scratches. Lucilla shuddered. She could not avoid the feeling that it had been a mistake to separate from the gola. The menu had been projected, she saw, and Bosmali already was scanning it.
I will order for you, he said.
Bosmali's way of saying he did not want her to make a mistake by ordering something a woman of the Hormu might avoid. It galled her to feel dependent. She was a reverend mother. She was trained to take command in any situation, mistress of her own destiny. How tiring all of this was. She gestured at the dirty window on her left where people could be seen passing on the narrow street.
I am losing business while we dally, Scar. There, that was in character.
Bosmali almost sighed.
At last, he thought.
She had begun to function once more as a reverend mother. He could not understand her abstracted attitude, the way she looked at the city and its people. Two milky drinks slid from the slot onto the table. Bosmali drank his in one swallow. Lucilla tested her drink on the tip of her tongue, sorting the contents, an imitation caffeate diluted with a nut-flavored juice. Bosmali gestured upward with his chin for her to drink it quickly. She obeyed, concealing a grimace at the chemical flavors. Bosmali's attention was on something over her right shoulder, but she dared not turn. That would be out of character.
Come!
He placed a coin on the table and hurried her out into the street. He smiled the smile of an eager customer, but there was wariness in his eyes. The tempo of the streets had changed. There were fewer people. The shadowy doors conveyed a deeper sense of menace. Lucilla reminded herself that she was supposed to represent a powerful guild whose members were immune to the common violence of the gutter. The few people on the street did make way for her, eyeing the dragons of her robe with every appearance of awe. Bosmali stopped at a doorway. It was like the others along this street, set back slightly from the walkway, so tall that it appeared narrower than it actually was. An old-fashioned security beam guarded the entrance. None of the newer systems had penetrated to the slum, apparently. The streets themselves were testimony to that, designed for ground cars. She doubted that there was a roof pad in the entire area. No sign of flitters or thopters could be heard or seen. There was music, though. A faint susurration reminiscent of Semuta. Something new in Semuta addiction? This would certainly be an area where addicts would go to ground. Lucilla looked up at the face of the building as Bosmali moved ahead of her and made their presence known by breaking the doorway beam. There were no windows in the building's face, only the faint glitterings of surface eyes here and there in the dull sheen of ancient plastile. They were old-fashioned comm eyes, she noted, much bigger than modern ones. A door deep in the shadows swung inward on silent hinges.
This way.
Bosmali reached back and urged her forward with a hand on her elbow. They entered a dimly lighted hallway that smelled of exotic foods and bitter essences. She was a moment identifying some of the things that assailed her nostrils. Mélange. She caught the unmistakable cinnamon ripeness. And yes, Semuta. She identified burned rice, Higgart salts. Someone was masking another kind of cooking. There were explosives being made here. She thought of warning Bosmali, but reconsidered. It was not necessary for him to know, and there might be ears in this confined space to hear whatever she said. Bosmali led the way up a shadowy flight of stairs with a dim glow strip along the slanting baseboard. At the top, he found a hidden switch concealed behind a patch in the patched and repatched wall. There was no sound when he pushed the switch, but Lucilla felt a change in the movement all around them. Silence. It was a new kind of silence in her experience. A crouching preparation for flight or violence. It was cold in the stairwell and she shivered, but not from the chill. Footsteps sounded beyond the doorway beside the patch-masked switch. A grey-haired hag in a yellow smock opened the door and peered up at them past her straggling eyebrows.
"It's you,"
she said, her voice wavering. She stood aside for them to enter. Lucilla glanced swiftly around the room as she heard the door close behind them. It was a room the unobservant might think shabby, but that was superficial. Underneath, it was quality. The shabbiness was another mask, partly a matter of this place having been fitted to a particularly demanding person. This goes here and nowhere else. That goes over there, and it stays there. The furnishings and bric-a-brac looked a little worn, but someone here did not object to that. The room felt better this way. It was that kind of room. Who possessed this room? The old woman? She was making her painful way toward a door on their left.
"We are not to be disturbed until dawn," Bosmali said.
The old woman stopped and turned. Lucilla studied her. Was this another who shammed advanced age? No, the age was real. Every motion was diffused by unsteadiness, a trembling of the neck, a failure of the body that betrayed her in ways she could not prevent.
"Even if it's somebody important?" the old woman asked in her wavering voice.
The eyes twitched when she spoke. Her mouth moved only minimally to emit the necessary sounds, spacing out her words as though she drew them from somewhere deep within. Her shoulders, curved from years of bending at some fixed work, would not straighten enough for her to look Bosmali in the eyes. She peered upward past her brows instead, an oddly furtive posture.
"What important person are you expecting?" Bosmali asked.
The old woman shuddered and appeared to take a long time understanding.
"Important people come here," she said.
Lucilla recognized the body signals and blurted it because Bosmali must know.
"She's from Rakis."
The old woman's curious upward gaze locked on Lucilla. The ancient voice said,
"I was a priestess, Hormo Lady."
"Of course she's from Rakis," Bosmali said.
His tone warned her not to question.
"I would not harm you,"
the hag whined.
"Do you still serve the divided god?"
Again there was that long delay for the old woman to respond.
"Many serve the great Guldur," she said.
Lucilla pursed her lips and once more scanned the room. The old woman had been reduced greatly in importance.
"I am glad I do not have to kill you," Lucilla said.
The old woman's jaw drooped open in a parody of surprise, while spittle dripped from her lips. This was a descendant of Fremen? Lucilla let her revulsion come out in a long shudder. This mendicant bit of flotsam had been shaped from a people who walked tall and proud, a people who died bravely. This one would die whining.
"Please trust me,"
the hag whined and fled the room.
"Why did you do that?"
Bosmali demanded.
"These are the ones who will get us to Rakis."
She merely looked at him, recognizing the fear in his question. It was fear for her.
"But I did not imprint him back there," she thought.
With a sense of shock, she realized that Bosmali had recognized hate in her.
"I hate them," she thought. "I hate the people of this planet."
That was a dangerous emotion for a reverend mother. Still, it burned in her. This planet had changed her in a way she did not want. She did not want the realization that such things could be. Intellectual understanding was one thing, experience was another.
Damn them!
But they already were damned. Her chest pained her.
Frustration. There was no escaping this new awareness. What had happened to these people? People?
The shells were here, but they no longer could be called fully alive. Dangerous, though. Supremely dangerous.
"We must rest while we can," Bosmali said.
"I do not have to earn my money?" she demanded. Bosmali paled.
"What we did was necessary. We were lucky, and were not stopped. But it could have happened."
"And this place is safe?"
"As safe as I can make it. Everyone here has been screened by me or by my people."
Lucilla found a long couch that smelled of old perfumes and composed herself there to scour her emotions of the dangerous hate. Where hate entered, love might follow. She heard Bosmali stretching out to rest on cushions against a nearby wall. Soon he was breathing deeply, but sleep evaded Lucilla. She kept sensing crowds of memories, things thrust forward by the others who shared her inner storerooms of thinking. Abruptly, inner vision gave her a glimpse of a street and faces, people moving in bright sunlight. It took a moment for her to realize that she saw all of this from a peculiar angle, that she was being cradled in someone's arms. She knew then that this was one of her own personal memories. She could place the one who held her, feel the warm heartbeat next to a warm cheek. Lucilla tasted the salt of her own tears. She realized then that Gamu had touched her more deeply than any experience since her first days in the Bene Gesserit schools.
Concealed behind strong barriers, the heart becomes ice. Darwi Adraid, Argument in Council. It was a group filled with fierce tensions. Terraza, wearing secret mail under her robe and mindful of the other precautions she had taken, Odraid, certain that there could be violence and consequently wary, Shiana, thoroughly briefed on the probabilities here and shielded behind three security mothers who moved with her like fleshly armour, Waf, worried that his reason might have been clouded by some mysterious Bene Gesserit artifice, the false Tuic, giving every evidence that he was about to erupt in rage, and nine of Tuic's Rakian counsellors, each angrily engaged in seeking ascendancy for self or family. In addition, five guardian acolytes, bred and trained by the Sisterhood for Physical Violence, stayed close to Terraza. Waf moved with an equal number of new face dancers. They had convened in the penthouse atop the Dar es Balat Museum. It was a long room with a wall of plaz facing west across a roof garden of lacy greenery. The interior was furnished with soft divans and was decorated with artful displays from the tyrant's no room. Odraid had argued against including Shiana, but Terraza remained adamant. The girl's effect on Waf and some of the priesthood represented an overwhelming advantage for the Bene Gesserit. There were dolben screens over the long wall of windows to keep out the worst glare of a westering sun. That the room faced west said something to Odraid. The windows looked into the land of gloaming, where Shai Khulud took his repose. It was a room focused on the past, on death. She admired the dolbens in front of her. They were flat, black slats, 10 molecules wide, and rotating in a transparent, liquid medium. Set automatically, the best Ixion dolbens admitted a predetermined level of light without much diminishing the view. Artists and antique dealers preferred them to polarizing systems, Odraid knew, because they admitted a full spectrum of available light. Their installation spoke of the uses to which this room was put, a display case for the best of the God Emperor's hoard. Yes, there was a gown that had been worn by his intended bride. The priestly counselors were arguing fiercely among themselves at one end of the room, ignoring the false Tuic. Terraza stood nearby, listening. Her expression said she thought the priests fools. Waf stood with his face dancer entourage near the wide entrance door. His attention shifted from Shiana to Odraid to Terraza, and only occasionally to the arguing priests. Every movement Waf made betrayed his uncertainties. Would the Bene Gesserit really support him? Could they together override Rakian opposition by peaceful means? Shiana and her shielding escort came to stand beside Odraid. The girl still showed stringy muscles, Odraid observed, but she was filling out, and the muscles had taken on a recognizable Bene Gesserit definition. The high planes of her cheekbones had grown softer under that olive skin, the brown eyes more liquid, but there were still red sunstreaks in her brown hair.
The attention she spared for the arguing priests said she was assessing what had been revealed to her in the briefing.
"Will they really fight?" she whispered. "Listen to them," Odraid said. "What will the Mother Superior do? Watch her carefully."
Both of them looked at Terraza standing in her group of muscular acolytes. Terraza now looked amused as she continued to observe the priests. The Rakian group had started their argument out in the roof garden. They had brought it inside as the shadows lengthened. They breathed angrily, muttering sometimes and then raising their voices. Did they not see how the mimic Tuek watched them? Odraid returned her attention to the horizon visible beyond the roof garden. Not another sign of life out there in the desert. Any direction you looked outward from Dar es Balat showed empty sand. People born and raised here had a different view of life and their planet than most of these priestly counselors. This was not the Rakkas of green belts and watered oases, which abounded in the higher latitudes like flowered fingers pointing into the long desert tracks. Out from Dar es Balat was the meridian desert that stretched like a cummerbund around the entire planet.
"I have heard enough of this nonsense," the false Tuek exploded. He pushed one of the counselors roughly aside and strode into the middle of the arguing group, pivoting to stare into each face. "Are you all mad?"
One of the priests, it was old Albertus, by the gods, looked across the room at Waf and called out,
"Sir Waf, will you please control your face, dancer?"
Waf hesitated and then moved toward the disputants, his entourage close behind. The false Tuek whirled and pointed a finger at Waf.
"You, stay where you are. I will brook no Tlelaxu interference. Your conspiracy is quite clear to me."
Odraid had been watching Waf as the mimic Tuek spoke. Surprise. The Bene Tlelax master had never before been addressed thus by one of his minions. What a shock. Rage convulsed his features. Humming sounds like the noises of angry insects came from his mouth, a modulated thing that clearly was some kind of language. The face dancers of his entourage froze, but the false Tuek merely returned attention to his counselors. Waf stopped humming. Consternation. His face dancer Tuek would not come to heel. He lurched into motion toward the priests. The false Tuek saw it and once more leveled a hand at him, the finger quivering.
"I told you to stay out of this. You might be able to do away with me, but you'll not saddle me with your Tlelaxu filth."
That did it. Waf stopped. Realization came over him. He shot a glance at Terraza, seeing her amused recognition of his predicament. Now he had a new target for his rage.
"You knew!"
"I suspected."
You
fashioned too well," Terraza said. "It's your own doing."
The priests were oblivious to this exchange. They shouted at the false Tuek, ordering him to shut up and remove himself, calling him a
damned face dancer.
Odraid studied the object of this attack with care. How deep did the print go? Had he really convinced himself that he was Tuek? In a sudden lull, the mimic drew himself up with dignity and sent a scornful glance at his accusers.
"You all know me," he said. "You all know my years of service to the divided god who is one god. I will go to him now if your conspiracy extends to that, but remember this, he knows what is in your hearts."
The priests looked as one man to Waf. None of them had seen a face dancer replace their high priest. There had been no body to see. Every bit of evidence was the evidence of human voices saying things that might be lies. Belatedly, several looked at Odraid. Her voice was one of those that had convinced them. Waf, too, was looking at Odraid. She smiled and addressed herself to the Tlelaxu master.
"It suits our purposes that the high priesthood not pass into other hands at this time," she said.
Waf immediately saw the advantage to himself. This was a wedge between priests and Bene Gesserit. This removed one of the most dangerous holds the sisterhood had on the Tlelaxu.
"It suits my purposes too," he said.
As the priests once more lifted their voices in anger, Terraza came in right on cue.
"Which of you will break our accord?" she demanded.
Tuek thrust two of his counselors aside and strode across the room to the Mother Superior. He stopped only a pace from her.
"What game is this?"
he asked.
"We support you against those who would replace you," she said. "The Bene Tlelaxu join us in this. It is our way of demonstrating that we, too, have a vote in selecting the High Priest."
Several priestly voices were raised in unison.
Is he or is he not a face dancer?
Terraza looked benignly at the man in front of her.
Are you a face dancer?
Of course not.
Terraza looked at O'Draid, who said,
There seems to have been a mistake.
O'Draid singled out Albertus among the priests and locked eyes with him.
Shianna, O'Draid said, what should the Church of the Divided God do now?